pod pastoring for you almost live from deep beneath the Boar's Head Tavern in the Internet Monk compound in St. Sadie's, Maryland. This is the voice of post-evangelicals everywhere, a voice of sanity in the midst of the internet circus. This is Internet Monk Radio, podcast number 73. Hello out there, podcast fans. This is your Internet Monk, Michael Spencer, with Internet Monk Radio, number 73. Glad to have you along. And I have a lot of things I want to plug today. If you've been at the website, you'll see that I'm plugging a couple of podcasts. These are podcasts from, one's from an Anglican church, one's from an Episcopal church. Good lectionary preaching. And some of you guys that have never heard a good lectionary preacher, and you've kind of got in your mind that the only good preaching out there is of a sort of a, you know, hour and 15 minute verse by verse, sort of thing, lots of theology, maybe not as much on the application. You need to check this out. You need to go to the two links that I have there. One is to St. Peter's Anglican Church in Tallahassee, Florida. The other is to Trinity Church in Greenwich, Connecticut, which is the church pastored by Ian Morgan Crone, who is the author of Chasing Francis, a book I reviewed a little while back. Go and subscribe to the podcast of those guys and check out some really good lectionary preaching focused on the teaching of Jesus, both of them preaching actually the same text because using the same lectionary. And you might be surprised and maybe rethink a little bit of your idea of what kind of preaching can go on in church and be helpful to everyone. I'm going to play a song from a new CD that I received few days ago to review. It's called Ghosts and Spirits. It's by a gentleman by the name of Phil Woodward. And Phil Woodward obviously does not work by himself. There's a lot of musicians on this CD, big band. Myron Marston is the guy who contacted me, and he plays lead guitar. And this is a concept album based on C.S. Lewis's book, The Great Divorce. And it is really good. I mean, you're obviously taking on a pretty substantial challenge to take a theological and imaginative and literary work like The Great Divorce and try to turn it into a concept record. And maybe it's a little bit 70s of me to be attracted to that kind of music. But if you like progressive rock, this is of the lighter variety, very eclectic, a lot of different kinds of songs, a lot of different kind of instruments. The songs really do capture the characters and the chapter and the feel of Lewis's book. And I'm going to play a part of one song here in the middle of the podcast, and then we'll play another one as we're going off today. You can get this CD at CD Baby. You can download it there. You can order it. Phil Woodward, Ghosts and Spirits. Phil Woodward, Ghosts and Spirits. Concept album based on C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, which if you've never read that, is a book about a busload of people from hell who spend a day in heaven. And I know that sounds really bizarre, but that's what it is. One of Lewis's best. So Phil Woodward, Ghosts and Spirits.
It's good to see newcomers, enjoy our endless summers, albeit damp and dark and gray. Here nothing ever changes. It's been the same for ages. We hope you all enjoy your stay. Yeah. No need for reservations. If you desire accommodations, just dream them up, they're yours for free. Feel free to settle near here. But we doubt you will, 'cause we're here. We suspect you'll want your privacy. Yeah. If you open your eyes, you'll see it's heaven. If you open your eyes, sure it's always
And that was The Gray Town from Phil Woodward's album Ghosts and Spirits, a musical recreation of C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce. Check that out at CD Baby. And there is lots of interesting music on that project. Thank you, Myron Marston, for passing that on to me. I think it's time to talk about some issues that came up on the blog this past week, internetmonk.com. On September the 22nd, I put up a post called Five Questions on the iMonk and Catholicism, subtitled, where I also discuss some of my thoughts on how various kinds of Christians should appreciate and love one another. And I said in that what I was doing was trying to maybe clear up some fairly confusing signals that I have thrown out there over the months about kind of where I am in regard to my Roman Catholic friends, brothers, and sisters. And a number of friendly Catholic bloggers have pointed out to me this sort of, sometimes sounds like two people blogging, one who's, you know, about to convert and one who comes off as, one person said, a little Jack Chicky, which I certainly don't want to come off. And I'm not going to bore you with what goes on inside of me as I kind of deal with all this. You can read posts like The River is Deep, The River is Wide, or Yo-Ho-Ho, A Papist Life for Me, which is a more serious piece than it sounds, and get my background, particularly the first post I mentioned there, The River is Deep, The River is Wide, and get a little sense of how my own Christian journey has been impacted by Roman Catholicism all along the way. And then at the same time, if you know my own roots and where I come from spiritually, where I was brought up, the church I was brought up in, then you may understand a little other side of my brain. So I'll kind of get on the psychiatrist's couch here and say that there are two angels sitting on my shoulder, one kind of talking one way about my Roman Catholic influences and another talking another way. So I plead guilty to that. And what I wanted to do was clarify that a little bit. And I had in mind about two posts, maybe three. I thought the first one I would kind of deal more with kind of maybe issues about authority, which was a particular thing with me, and then how I feel whenever people are trying to convert me, a little bit about the two different kinds of Roman Catholic influences that I have encountered in my own experience, things like that. And then in another post, which I have not written and don't know if I'm going to write, I wanted to talk about spirituality, particularly, and the claims of Protestant and Catholic sides about spirituality. Well, what happens is this post gets big time notice at Ignatius Insight Scoop, and it actually gets two big posts over there. And the first one kind of took apart a good bit of what I said on authority under the title, Why I'm Not a Protestant. And this kind of, I think, was a straw that broke the camel's back kind of experience for me. Probably because I have a lot of respect for Carl Olson at Ignatius Insight. I like his writing. But it just seems like that every voice that comes back to me when I send out signals into the blogosphere, when it's the subject is Catholicism, every voice that comes back is a voice of Protestant converts to Catholicism. And it's a very different voice than the voice I'm talking to when I write what I write. And I've realized this. I've come to realize that I basically am talking to the Roman Catholics in my past who were all cradle Catholics who didn't understand Protestantism at all. And I'm trying to explain myself. And what I'm getting back is feedback from people who know Protestantism very well, and they've bailed on Protestantism, and they are probably readers of my blog because I'm pretty critical of a lot of evangelical Protestants. but then when they feed back, it's from that standpoint, you know, why Protestantism is wrong, as opposed to, well, we don't know anything about it or don't understand it. The first position, the sort of, we don't understand it, we don't know anything about it, and as when I go into teaching mode and you know, explain kind of where I am, then I think I'm being helpful. When the response comes back for more of the Protestant converts who are now apologist side, then it's more, here's the various flaws in your thinking. So I don't know, this became a bit of a straw that broke the camel's back thing for me. It fits right in with the recent experience I've had with a lot of Reformed folks in regard to some of my modest critiques of the theodicy, not the theology, but the theodicy of John Piper. Of course, a number of people have brought the same things up. Ben Witherington wrote a very critical piece on John Piper's theodicy. So I'm not the only one out there who brought this up. But I try to think of myself in what Into Your Eye talks about, critical engagement, which to me is a bridge building exercise. And my bridge building exercise just seems to result in more lines being drawn, not between our two positions, but lines that to me are about me. And I know I'm going to get criticized for saying, well, it's all about me, but here's the deal. And this again comes out of my experience working with students. When discussing ideas and positions and beliefs, sticking somebody's name at the top of everything makes it more of a personal exercise. I'm not calling it a personal attack, because it wasn't a personal attack, but it was a critique of, you know, Michael Spencer's position explaining Protestantism. And it's as if, in all of these instances, it's Michael Spencer's criticism of John Piper. It's Michael Spencer's criticism of Roman Catholicism. And somebody write me and tell me if I'm wrong, but I'm not articulating Michael Spencer's anything. I'm articulating typical points of dialogue that are not original with me, and they're not even highly identified with me. They're just the ones that I tend to identify with. And the other thing is that I've never tried in any of these analytical pieces to put forward a kind of, I speak for the whole Christian world, or I have, you know, the final word on what you ought to think. And there are some people that do, you know, come off that way, as if I am we are the spokesman for true evangelicalism. You know, we are the Total Truth Society. We have the right to arrest all of, Christendom that disagrees with us. I do not try to come off that way. So anyway, I then went back and posted that, well, I'm going to quit writing these pieces that are engaging theological team sports and the various positions and traditions. I'm going to engage theology, but I'm just going to quit trying this bridge building, quit this bridge building stuff, at least for the foreseeable future, and quit trying to be a participant in a conversation that winds up being about denominations and personalities, because the internet is just far too joined up with, you know, everybody carrying a flag for that to work. I also then in there said that I had removed some books from my shelf and was donating them to the local Roman Catholic Church. And then that came back over at Olson's blog in the comments as I was throwing books away. And it was sort of coming off like I was, you know, had run out, was cutting my hair in the front yard and burning books in a pile. And I gave away a bunch of John Piper books to two other ministers, kept six. I gave away a few Ignatius Press books, have a bunch still on my shelf. And look, sometimes the saying I'm not going to read that book is just my way of putting something behind me and moving on. It's just a tangible way of doing that. And I guess the internet is so full of bibliophiles that if you do something to a book, it's sort of like stabbing yourself in the eye with pins or something. Trust me, if you would have watched the whole spectacle of me removing the book, putting them in the plastic bag, and setting them by the door to be delivered to the local Roman Catholic Church or the two minister friends, nothing would have looked particularly crazy. So then I got a whole bunch of blog posts saying, don't stop blogging, which I never even insinuated I was going to do. I said I was going to make some changes in the content of my blog posts, and I was going to get off of this business of engaging and discussing with various theological teams. As somebody said, you know, I try to do two things. I try to be very critical, and I try to be very vulnerable, and that is probably a no-win. In my mind, it's not a no-win. In my mind, there is a way to be both, and that is to be willing to, in your own writing, admit your own flaws. And that should put you in a better position, I hope, to be analytical. But I guess I've just really run out of gas for the whole enterprise. Not that, you know, I don't want to be friends with the Carl Olsons and all the other people who have written pieces about me, you know, down through the years. Justin Taylor just went after me a while back on a thing that I wrote. It's not that I don't want to be friends with these guys, you know, whatever blogdom friendship means. It's just that having my name on the front end of critiques that basically are made by thousands of people and have been made for hundreds of years, turning it into a discussion about me, and then out come the iMonk haters, you know, the weirdos that are, you know, got me in their mind portrayed as some kind of drooling, axe wielding, heretical idiot, you know, like I'm the security force for Brian McLaren, you know, and I don't know what in the world these people think. But, you know, once my name becomes at the top of the thread, then out all this comes. And then those of you that read internetmonk.com know there are certain blogs that just get highly energized anytime they can get my name on there. So I'm going to try to blog a little less in those terms and a little more in terms of things that we can all share, things that pertain to all of us. And I'm still going to blog about theological topics, and I'm still going to say a few things about certainly my Southern Baptist Convention from time to time. But across that Reform divide and across that Catholic divide, my tone's going to be different. Best I can do it, my tone's going to be different. I'm part of a Bible study that meets a couple of times a week. It's been going through the book of 1 Timothy. I'm not the teacher. I've been the teacher of this Bible study for a while, but another good brother is teaching, and I get to just sit and participate, which is great because when I'm not doing the talking, I get to make lots and lots of notes and lots of ideas for preaching come along. And we've been in 1 Timothy chapter 2 in the last couple of days, and we came across this passage. And I wanted to say a little something about the way it was approached and some things that crossed my mind. 1 Timothy chapter 2, I'm going to begin with verse 8. I desire then that in every place that the men should pray, lifting holy hands without anger or quarreling. Likewise also that women should adorn themselves in respectable apparel, with modesty and self-control, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly attire, but with what is proper for women who profess godliness, with good works. Let a woman learn quietly with all submissiveness. I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man. Rather, she is to remain quiet, for Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. Yet she will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith and love and holiness with self-control. Now, I'm sure all of you that are Bible teachers and preachers would say that you have a proper dread of interpreting all that in the contemporary context. There's a lot of things going on there. No doubt in my mind, this is a passage that really the first century background is very important. And I mean, I could go into lots of ways. I do not permit a woman to teach or exercise authority over man's clear enough. But when you go to the rest of the New Testament, statements about the various things that women did do in church involving speaking, like prophesying and teaching other women and so forth, you realize that there's a lot of nuance there. I think it all still holds together in terms of Paul not allowing women into the pastoral office. And of course, then there's another whole discussion about, is that cultural or is that something that's transcultural and that is part of the way Christianity is to be practiced no matter what the culture. What was really more interesting to me is that when you cross this passage in verse 9 about women adorning themselves, likewise also that women should adorn themselves in respectable apparel with modesty and self-control, that it appears to me that if you put that verse down in almost any group of American Christians and say, all right, what is Paul talking about? You're going to get back that women shouldn't wear provocative or revealing clothing. And the discussion is going to go in the direction of women should be modest. They shouldn't dress in a way that causes men to notice them and in a way that is anyway revealing or provocative. Now, I'm not really here to argue that point other than to say, I think that's bringing a lot to the text. The standard explanation that churches like the church in Corinth and Ephesus, if that's the background of Timothy's ministry, that these churches had a situation where women tended to come to church dressed in a way that would be associated with prostitutes. I don't know about that. That is a very quick judgment that I'd like to know a lot more about. I'm much more interested in how these passages interact with some other issues that I think were very big in these first century congregations, and that has to do with the division between rich and poor, with the demonstration that someone had wealth and parading that demonstration of wealth in the church in a way that made the separation between rich and poor visible. You know, there are quite a few passages in the New Testament, particularly over in the book of James, where this sort of thing is dealt with directly about giving honor to the rich and the rich parading their wealth, their material possessions, and the power and prestige that those bring. Jesus criticizes that very strongly in Revelation chapters 2 and 3. And so, I mean, if you listen to verse 9 and 10 again and kind of eliminate the presupposition that it's talking about some sort of, you know, sexually provocative clothing, and you say, okay, it's Paul telling Timothy to not let the materialistic adornment of women become a matter of the church accepting, you know, these statements of fashion and status and money. It makes perfect sense that women should adorn themselves in respectable apparel with modesty and self-control. And the modesty and self-control do not necessarily have to refer to sexuality, but to restraining your materialistic desires and your desire to appear to be, you know, upper class and to have money in the culture and to be trendy and to be fashionable and, you know, to dress like you're successful, not with braided hair, gold, pearls, or costly attire. There's four things just listed right there, all that are clearly about material things and not about anything sexually provocative. But instead, adorn yourself with what is proper for women who profess godliness, good works. And good works, in the New Testament sense, are almost always aimed as the assistance of the poor or the humble or people of less means. So I'm just curious if anybody else has noticed that there's kind of an Americanizing that goes on with a passage like that, that we say, well, this is talking about don't come in with a plunging neckline or a short skirt. And I think it may be talking to men and women. And by the way, in the church, men would have been writing the check for their wives to dress in a way that paraded their materialistic possessions. We kind of navigate around that text so that we don't have to deal with the implications that it has for us. You know, driving in the parking lot with that car and wearing those jewels and those clothes and those brand names and all that stuff that we accept in our American culture as being just fine. And of course, it's not fine. It's Jesus' favorite thing to criticize in so many ways was our enslavement to mammon and our assumption that money brings the kind of things that only God can bring. Well, listen, it's been great to be with you. I'm going to play another cut from Phil Woodward's Ghosts and Spirits on the way out. You can get that CD at cdbaby.com. It's called Ghosts and Spirits, Phil Woodward, and you will like it, even if you don't like C.S. Lewis and The Great Divorce. So until next time, this is Michael Spencer, the Internet Monk, and you can read my stuff at internetmonk.com, and you can get this podcast at iTunes. I'll see you.
I saw it only for a single split second, but I saw it all the same. I watched in wonder as the world's walls opened and my vision always changed. Description via words and sounds and colors, all this glory and grace defied. Still I offer these my feeble, frail phrases, 'cause I cannot help but try. I watched as she walked through her yard in